center community. Sitting across the table from me is Cameron Enix. And very excited to have him with us for a conversation today. Cameron will talk about his background. I need not do that. But he is going to touch on early Judaism and the New Testament. And we're going to be moving through, ideally, three frames: New Testament and Jewish literature, how Jews read the Bible, and then what's the final frame? It's essentially about anti-Semitism, isn't it?
Anti-Semitism, yeah. So Christianity's kind of influence or role within anti-Semitism.
Which is a... each of these deserves its own treatment.
Yeah.
But so in that way, this could be considered a survey.
Yeah.
Cameron's background, I think, uniquely qualifies him to lead us in conversation on this. Do you want to talk a little bit about?
Yeah. So, I mean, as far as like what I've studied or my academic background, so I did my undergraduate studies at Evangel here in Springfield. I actually started...
Never heard of it. But go ahead anyway.
I actually started out studying music industry, failed music theory, and at which point I thought, well, maybe I should go into biblical studies. And so I did. I graduated with a major in biblical languages, but a minor in Jewish studies. And so that's kind of what first got me interested in studying early Judaism. So from there, I spent a year out in NIAC, in New York City, in a program where we studied ancient Judaism and Christian origins. I've been to, like, Israel, I think, three times now on various study trips during the summer. Got to dig at a place called El Arash, which they now think is a possible site for Beit Seda in the New Testament. And so eventually that led me back to Missouri State because it's way cheaper here. So
yeah.
I'm currently finishing up my master's degree in religious studies with a focus on early Judaism. So
it's a very, it's a rich background. And
yeah.
I think one that many people would probably be quite envious of, to have those kind of academic opportunities to specialize so much in one area.
Yeah. Well, and it's brought me to a great place because now I have my dream job where I don't get paid enough and I get to live off the government right now. So
right. Everything
really
is falling
pays.
Into every all of the pieces. It's all lining up. So we want to, you know, we want to all benefit from that expertise. I think one of the challenges, so I think actually this is an important place to start. And I've found myself in this place, whether speaking at center or teaching one of my New Testament classes or one of my Hebrew Bible classes. It's if you have that very specific area of interest or expertise, you can kind of do those deep dives, and it's just intrinsically valuable.
Yeah,
it gives you have the energy to wade through sometimes hundreds of pages.
Yeah.
To find certain gems of insight.
Mm-hmm.
How to start a little bit with that question, like I suppose the why question, why would somebody who has not done those deep dives, they don't have that academic background or test,
mm-hmm.
like what's the payoff, and how does somebody like kind of get into that?
Hmm.
In a way that's accessible, like, you know, I think of the many people in our community that they have different areas of expertise,
yeah.
professional or academic.
Yeah.
But maybe this isn't probably one. So,
yeah.
like, how do they? What's the onboarding mechanism that's like reasonable
yeah.
to expect?
Yeah.
From them.
Well, so, and really, this is one of the things I'm passionate about. I'm glad you asked that because I don't actually think it's that hard to dive into any of these questions or topics.
Wikipedia.
It's surprisingly good sometimes, but
that's all we use here. It's just Wikipedia.
My thesis
50 tabs, all Wikipedia.
No, but meaning as far as approaching the literature, really, all it takes is a willingness not only to read slowly through the New Testament, which may also be new for some too, because honestly, reading our own Bible is hard enough sometimes.
In some ways, I think these kinds of conversations actually may renew one's interest in one's willingness to, like, as you say, go through the Bible slowly.
Yeah.
But elaborate on that and then continue with your answer, your response.
So I think thinking about Judaism is a perfect way to actually answer that question. Because, for example, if you take how many Orthodox Jews and throughout history, like how they've been taught to read the Talmud, which is a tremendously complex, obtuse text, much more complicated than the Bible. Not only to read it, but read it in its original Aramaic, which the way that happens is you don't have two or three semesters of Hebrew or Aramaic grammar, you're just thrown into it. And I think the key part is that you have a partner. You have somebody you study with. And so honestly, if I had to answer the question, how does one get into either the Bible or studying Jewish literature, it's with a partner or with somebody else that you can have conversations with. Because really, at the end of the day, I think a lot of good learning and insight comes from debating things, being able to read a passage in the New Testament or Old Testament and just ask the question, what the heck's going on here?
Yeah. You're tapping into, I'm sure you'll get to this in that kind of second frame, but how Jews read the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this rich tradition of self-critique and debate.
Yeah.
You know, the conversation that surrounds, you know.
So nobody needs to be an expert. Like, you don't need to be an expert to start off reading this, to either read the Bible or read anything else. I think if you find a good study Bible, I mean, we've got two here on the table, and you find one or two good books or introductions, it's enough to just jump in the waters and start making the connections for yourself, I think.
Yeah.
So
let's jump in, because I think it's going to be rich for, well, actually, I'll answer that question as well, and I don't want it to seem, this will, I hope, our listeners understand what I mean when I say that understanding Judaism for the sake of Christianity is really, an unfair way to frame the whole thing, the whole discussion. But it is understandable that at the center of these things is a question of, you know, is how does this affect my understanding of Jesus?
Yeah.
How does this shape my understanding of Paul? To just kind of anchor it in that way. And look, you can't understand Jesus if you don't understand his context. You're going to misunderstand Jesus if you misunderstand his context. You're going to misunderstand Paul if you misunderstand his context. And that's, to your point, that's why the conversation and the debate is really useful if people can find ways to dig into that. Let's get into this then a little bit. Maybe it's useful to first talk about at least to take 30 seconds, because I don't want to bore anybody with this, but it's really important to do maybe a brief history of like what. So you, I think, in our discussion leading into this, you use the language of early Judaism. You have like much of this comes from the German tradition of like they'll use the language of early and late. I don't want to overcomplicate this. So, like, if we were to like quickly frame, you know, some history of Judaism, right? Like some of the history of Judaism.
Yeah.
Like, can we walk through that for a minute? Am I putting you too much on the spot to walk through that?
No.
I mean, we have ancient Judaism.
Yeah.
We have rabbinic Judaism, Hellenistic Judaism. Walk us through that for a second.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. I mean, and this is important because I think if you're going to understand anything about Judaism, it's that it's very diverse. both currently, but also historically. I mean, it's changed a lot. But when I say that, I'll also always say that it's surprisingly uniform or consistent. It's one of the few religions and people groups you can look at where a lot stays the same. So when I talk about early Judaism, I'm talking about, say, from 300 BC to about 200 AD. People also talk about Greco-Roman era Judaism. So we're talking about the period after the return from exile, when the temple's rebuilt. You have a renewing. It's no longer Israelite society, or even Southern Judean society. When you look,
we're talking about 300 BC.
Yes,
all like leading up to. Did you say 70 or
200?
200. Yeah. Okay, so, which is the early Judaism period.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in these markers and. As far as dates aren't precise. I mean,
right.
A lot of people want to throw out 70 AD because that's when the temple was destroyed.
Right.
And that is a pivotal moment, but Judaism didn't all of a sudden change overnight. Right.
Right.
And so that's early Judaism, which we talk about the literature during that period. I include the New Testament in that. And then, as you kind of mentioned, you also have the rabbinic period, which is the development of Judaism around kind of these rabbinic guilds and these conversations around oral Torah, starting from 200 after up till about, usually it's about 500 or 600.
When you get into medieval
era. Yeah. And so then you get into kind of modern Judaism, which we're looking at European Judaism throughout Europe, in the various locations. And then to what it is today. And so, for example, today, I think a lot of people, when they think Judaism, they do think about kind of, honestly, they probably think about Hasidic Judaism a lot of the time. So you have the big fur hats and the big black coats. You have people speaking Yiddish and things like that.
Yeah, what do people think about when they hear Judaism today?
Yeah.
Very interesting question.
Yeah, I mean,
it depends so much on, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to maybe ask you, like, what had you, if you could remember.
I don't know if I'm not... Now it sounds like a dodge, but I don't know that I'm a good example because pretty early in my like academic life, I'm like talking early 20s, I was beginning to like look into ancient Judaism.
Yeah.
But I got to be honest. I mean, I think it depends on where you live, obviously.
Yeah.
And it depends on your upbringing.
Yeah.
You might think of a kind of Orthodox Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And probably if you're from the Midwest, that may look like something you've seen in a movie.
Yeah.
But honestly, you might be thinking about Seinfeld.
Oh, you might
be thinking about, I mean, really, you might be thinking about kind of some kind of secular Judaism.
Yeah, that's true.
which is, I mean, I don't think any of our like 20-somethings are thinking Seinfeld unless you had the privilege of growing up in a household where your dad watched it.
If you're not, assignment one is to go back and watch all of Seinfeld.
Yeah, I mean, really, this Judaism. Needs to diverge into us just watching and discussing
or Big
the
Mouth.
Genius of Seinfeld. But I do think that, like, at a broad cultural level, I don't know that there's a single idea that floats into people's minds.
Well, and it's
when it comes to modern Judaism, particularly, right?
Because you talk about the Midwest, like the Midwest is definitely central Midwest, at least,
right?
There's not a lot of Jewish people around here,
right?
There are, and there are a few synagogues close by, but it's not a huge part of our life out here. In fact, when I lived in New York, I mean, that was Jewish central. And anytime I talk to a Jewish person out there, they would be like, Missouri, is that like by Canada? It's like, no, never heard of it.
No.
So, it's on the way to California. So. So I think a lot of people in their minds, they probably have some kind of particular conception. A lot of times it's an Orthodox Jewish person or a Hasidic Jewish person. So usually it's some perception like that. And yet even today, as you kind of already pointed out, there's not every Jew today is religious. There's still an ethnic identity there.
Right.
And you also have kind of a liberal branch of Judaism, so like Reform Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
The modern Judaism has kind of gone through what Christianity has gone through. You have conservative, you have Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, and then on the left side you have Reform Judaism. And then you now also have Messianic Judaism,
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the weird Christian churches that, like, think they're Jews. I'm talking, like, legitimate, like,
Right, yeah. Exactly. And actually, I mean, we'll have to be disciplined, I think, in the conversation, because that is also a very interesting kind of micro, culture, where there's this interesting kind of attempt to adopt
Jewish customs and
certain customs, which inevitably probably, I mean, which inevitably goes wrong because it's not authentically Jewish.
Yeah.
And this is usually Christianity misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Its relationship to Judaism in the Bible. So actually to get closer to your, to actually, and we might have agreement or disagreement on this, but I also think that if we're talking about again, like the Midwest, you know, the people within our listenership, they may have, if they've grown up in evangelical Christianity, and I don't know that we really touched this, they will have a very specific understanding of Judaism that is entirely informed by, almost certainly informed by their pastor or what they hear in Sunday school or kind of what's in the water there. And I actually think that is one of the more potentially heinous and pernicious understandings of Judaism, where I think there are like well-meaning people within the Christian community that I don't know, they're thinking that most Jews are still making a temple sacrifice or something. I mean, there's still an animal being slaughtered or something. I mean, there may be real and very serious misunderstandings of Judaism.
Yeah, that's a good point. It was perhaps the other, if it's not Hasidic, then it's evangelical Christianity's kind of fetishizing Judaism in the modern state of Israel in particular.
Right.
And a lot of that's from like dispensational theology. It's about end times and prophecies about that. And so I think, yeah.
So I think that, or my hope is that in addition to, as we walk through these frames, my hope is that also some of that will be clear. Because I think that once we'll understand Christianity, what I mean to say is Jesus and Paul and the New Testament with more clarity, but also hopefully it will be a sort of corrective.
Yeah.
Against maybe some misunderstandings.
Yeah, there's more benefit to be derived from understanding Judaism than just, well, there'll be a millennial kingdom or something like that, and they're an end times cog in the wheel,
Right.
So.
Right. You can really get into the weeds with, like, the history of Judaism. I think maybe the most helpful frame is probably thinking about it in you use the language of early Judaism, which you're extending all the way to 200 AD or so.
Yeah.
I think that's very useful. 300 BCE to 200 AD or so. Yeah. You can break it down as well into, if you want, you can think about it as ancient, Hellenistic, rabbinic, which will take you to around 200 AD or so. So depending on like kind of your school and how much you want to do a deep dive, I think you can think about it in those ways.
Well,
now you've got a nice kind of overview to begin to Google and YouTube and so on.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. Like, use those terms and search around. And Wikipedia is fine.
Absolutely.
It's a fine place to start.
Yeah. The bibliographies there are very useful.
And I'll throw in the reason for those different terminologies. Really, they are kind of important culturally. This may come up in the anti-Semitism section.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason, like, we avoid, like, late Judaism... is because often that concept was used pejoratively, like in early German scholarship, to mean old stale Judaism.
Right.
So there was the Judaism of the prophets, and then there was the Judaism of the first century, which was old and stale and legalistic, and Jesus came along and threw that out. so we use like early Judaism or Hellenistic or something like that to talk more with less bias, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
So many interesting things. Okay, where do we go with this?
Well,
I'm tempted to just start to talk about things I want to hear.
Bring them up.
Exercising discipline to make sure we.
Well, so the first
stand or 3 hours.
Yeah, the first heading I have here is I want to talk about New Testament as Jewish literature, and I like framing it that way because there's a shift in terminology there. Like, I use that phrase because we don't just want to study Judaism as, I think you kind of mentioned, the background of Christianity or the background of the New Testament. Judaism isn't just a foil for the Christian story. It is the home and the landscape of early Christianity and Jesus and the early church. So I speak of the New Testament as Jewish literature because in a very real sense, a huge chunk is written by Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And even those that are not are still heavily influenced and saturated in that culture. Even where it begins to break away, it's still there. So,
I want to run with the... I'm going to take a minute to talk about Judaism as a foil.
Yeah.
And this is where... Well, I think of at times I've said something at center and I'll get a text message later or comment later, like, where was that sourced? Or okay. is that a correct representation of the same way that you might talk about like Western ideas?
Yeah.
You know, in the West, we think in this way.
Yeah, it's oversimplification.
This gross oversimplification.
Yeah.
There is, I think, this archetype that's constructed.
Yeah.
And I think it happens on... I just really think that it happens at the pulpit, as it were, because you're working within 45 minutes or 60 minutes. And I'm not trying to provide excuses there. I just simply think it's part of the problem. There's this archetype that's constructed, like, as if Jesus isn't interesting enough on his own. He needs an enemy.
Yeah.
He needs to have some kind of system that he's constantly subverting.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I think that is one of the most, again, I just think it's one of the most unhelpful ways of thinking about, you know, I mean, Jesus was a... not only was he a Jew, he was a practicing Jew who was going to temple, who loved and honored the law and the prophets.
Yeah.
We could go on.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea of like how like Jesus somehow can't be fascinating and the Son of God or something on his own.
Yeah.
We've got to have a foil.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well,
it's a corrective that I think we all might find useful.
Yeah, and let me provide, I guess the first thing I would say is, to be fair, the New Testament itself, at least the Gospels, often provide their own foil. So when Jesus is constantly, or frequently, arguing with the scribes and the Pharisees, and just to be clear, like, between the Gospels, those aren't always consistent. Like, sometimes Luke might just have the scribes, where Matthew puts in the Pharisees, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole issue there, but either way, there seems to be early on within gospel literature that Jesus' teaching career was framed as if he's often butting up against or having, maybe in a more charitable terms, a dialogue with scribes and Pharisees. And I actually think that's historically the case. I think there's truth to that. But rhetorically, the way the gospels frame it is often kind of antagonistic. And there's probably historical reasons for that. So it's hard not to, when you're talking about Jesus or preaching through the New Testament, to have immediately set up comes some kind of us versus them, or Jesus versus Jews, or Paul versus Jews, or, you know, while forgetting the fact that Paul himself says, like, actually some of his biggest enemies were Christians.
Right.
The churches rejected him all throughout, you know, Asia Minor, things like that. So,
and Paul proudly identifies himself as a Jew.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so, but what's unhelpful, so what's unhelpful, though, and I think this is part of Christian history and part of Christian theology, but because we've continually put that Judaism up as a foil, and we've misunderstood Judaism as the catchword still is legalistic, it really does boil down to, though, a lack of familiarity with Judaism and what it looked like, and as a genuine religious expression. So we think in terms of theology, Jesus has some theology, the Jews have another theology, forgetting that actually Jesus is Jewish, that it's not just theology, it's culture, it's religion, it's daily life, that Jesus himself also is absolutely a part of. He is a Jew, and he's thoroughly Jewish.
Right.
So it is a historical and hard question to dive into, though, as you read the Gospels, to separate that, to look at where's polemic happening, and where is kind of this rhetorical device being used to set Jesus up against certain things, and how can we separate sometimes the Gospel's rhetorical aim from, like, Jesus' own perception of himself or the Jewish perception of themselves, you know? Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense, and I think that much to say about this, but I think that to maybe reconcile a couple of your comments with my initial observation or question, there is no doubt a rhetorical device that's being used through the Gospels with Jesus and then in Paul's letters that is at times vitriolic. But we should have no issue with this, understanding that this is an intramural conversation. In the same way that we may have genuine disagreements within the same faith community, we see this with Jesus. We see this with Paul. Of course, I'm oversimplifying for sake of time. There is an older reading of Paul that he's antinomial. This is to say that Paul is over and against the law. But I think that not only is current scholarship in this place, but I think it's correct that Paul is speaking from within Judaism. Now, hopefully we'll get to that. We should rewind a minute, because I don't want us to leave this too quickly. I want us to make sure the groundwork is clear. What did early Judaism look like? And this is where I'll I'd just love to, you know, how would you frame that big question in a way that is bite-sized enough for our community to begin to process?
First, Judaism, early Judaism, is not the Old Testament. You can't just read the Old Testament and think, oh, well, that's Judaism. That's what they believed, right? It's not just the Law of Moses. It's actually reading the Old Testament and, I don't want to say developing a totally new religion, but it is genuine new interpretations in a religion unto itself. So that the person in ancient Israel would find a lot different if he looked at somebody in the first century in the land of Israel. As far as what it looked like, I like to actually use a scholar by the name of James Dunn. Kind of helpfully laid some of this out, but...
You don't call him Jimmy?
Jimmy? No, I'm not familiar with Jimmy. Okay. We haven't had coffee yet.
So. Okay.
but he points out...
Jimmy Dunn, it has less of a... It has less gravitas.
I could say James D.G. Dunn.
Okay, there we go.
If you're a New Testament scholar, you have to have multiple letters in the front or the middle of your name. So,
that's right.
Yeah. Right. So as far as core beliefs in early Judaism, there are 5 to 7. And so the first would be that God is one. And that often takes the form both of there's only one God, but also God is singular, like we're probably more familiar with. The second belief is that Israel is God's chosen people. And so I do like to remind people that Jews in the New Testament are still thinking of themselves in terms as a people group as Israel. Like, that's their identified name. So they are God's chosen people. The third key religious and cultural belief is the centrality of the Torah for daily life and practice. And I think this is the hardest one for people to grasp because, again, not only do we come up thinking that obeying the Old Testament is legalistic, we also can't seem to wrap our heads around what that looks like, but I'll explain that after I get through the rest of these. The fourth belief would then be the land of Israel is God's chosen land or place. Even for Jews who live outside the land of Israel during this time, they still look towards Israel as a sacred place, okay? Just like Muslims today might not live in Saudi Arabia, but they still look towards Mecca, you know, as the sacred place. The fifth idea is that the temple is God's presence on earth. It is still a sacred place for every Jew. Now, I should say almost every Jew, because there's an issue about the Essenes there. But even if they reject the temple in its current state, the temple still should be there, and it still should be operated according to their standards. The same holds for Jesus, who goes into the temple. For example, you know, we go back to the issues of how do I introduce people to this. I actually honestly just prefer kind of the shock approach, which is to pick certain parts.
You surprise
of
the, people.
Yeah, pick certain parts
of
the New Testament.
You jump out behind a corner in an alley.
And I'm like, Jews.
Blasting people with information about ancient Judaism. Yeah.
One thing I like to bring up is this constant conversation around what's going on in the temple when Jesus turns over the table.
Very good example.
Yeah, and I think for most Christians, at least in Christian theology and evangelical theology, I've heard this at least. I'm sure it's not everywhere, but I grew up hearing it, that Jesus was repudiating the temple system. He was repudiating legalism and essentially Judaism. He was revolutionary. One, I hate that word. I hate revolution. But Jesus was revolutionary, and he flipped things upside down. And there are parts that he does that, but it has nothing to do with the temple. Jesus went to the temple. He prayed in the temple. He taught in the temple.
And isn't he teaching in the temple a few days after that account?
Yes. Yeah, he's still there.
So it's not... Yeah. So whatever's happening in that account, it's not so revolutionary.
No, there's...
That a few days later, he's not actually, again, at offering his mission, offering his teachings.
Yeah. Well, and you know...
As a rabbi.
The irony there is that it's the authorities that crucify him that accuse him of wanting to destroy the temple. And the irony is that we often, in our sermons and our conversations, take the side of Jesus' accusers. When Jesus himself, he says, tear this down and I'll raise it up in 3 days. And the gospel gives a certain interpretation there. But it's clearly not, the temple is done. Get rid of it.
Right.
But we somehow then take the side of his accusers and say, yeah, that's what he said.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but rather than that, if you actually pay attention both to the literary and historical context, I think, what you see happening, there's a softer version, which people say, well, he's not trying to get rid of the temple, but just like the religion of Judaism as it existed or the ideas. It's not even that. I think what Jesus is doing is very particular, and that's basically getting pissed off at the racketeering that's going on in the temple.
Yeah. So there, the phrase like den of thieves, den of robbers.
Yeah.
One reading of that, to knock this idea around for a minute, one reading of that, and I'm kind of tapping into trying to remember exactly how it's framed, but one reading is, I think this is the reading that you're disputing, which is that in the moment of temple sacrifice, you have people that are extorting those who are coming to the temple. Mm-hmm. Another reading... which I think is a reading that I prefer, is this den of robbers, den of thieves, is more about probably doing business on the Sabbath and gathering money there. And so basically what you have then is do your business 6 days of the week, honor the Sabbath.
Yeah.
And when you're doing business 6 days of the week, do it in a way that is ethical and moral.
Yeah. I don't think those readings have to be opposed.
No, I don't think they're necessarily opposed. Yeah. I just, I mean, there might be some distance, there might be some areas of disagreement there, or dissonance there. But I guess what I'm saying is Jesus who is interested in the ethics of how we handle our money and our business and honoring the Sabbath rightly is not, that's not as much about revolution.
Yeah.
As it is, I think, a more interesting thing, which is like, you know what's really hard?
Yeah.
Really hard to do business in a way that's upright.
Yeah.
You know what's really hard? Really hard to keep the Sabbath.
Yeah. Well, and think of how much more relevant that is. When I talk about this, like, anything I can think of that a new, not new reading, but like, when I try to bring these shock moments and say, I think here's what's actually happening, to me it actually always seems to end up in a more relevant reading.
Yeah.
Like, it is far
or richer, right? Like, just a more giving. Yeah.
Like, isn't it far more, valuable and instructional to see Jesus having a statement or a conversation about the way business is done or when it's done or how to observe the set, you know, than it is a more highfalutin theological issue about well, this era is done, and now it's all about me and Christianity.
You and know? Also, isn't it harder to sell books when you can't have, like, the titles of, like,
yeah.
Revolution? You know,
oh,
like...
yeah, absolutely.
You
oh,
know, I mean, whatever kind of Zondervan, like...
Yeah.
Why am I targeting Zondervan? They publish fine books, and I would love a opportunity to publish with no, but yeah, yeah. But well, like,
yeah.
But like, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you go to any Christian bookstore, and it's like yeah. whatever kind of catchy title that has to be meant for like a 16-year-old.
Yeah, it has
in
to,
a youth group or
yeah,
something.
It has to go against the status quo, you know, because that's what we create. Like, I don't know. That does feel very young, but also it feels very. We ourselves currently as Christians, I think, in our age range.
Your age range?
Yeah.
I'm turning 62 yeah, okay. this year.
62.
Retirement's around the corner.
We've gone against the status quo. No, we've left kind of traditional churches often. Right. And so it feels very comforting to have a Jesus who is revolutionary and is cast in terms of saying something entirely new. Whereas the more realistic picture is... It's not that Jesus came just to confirm the status quo, sure. But he still fits within his own religion. He's Jewish, and he actually cares about, you know, the temple. He cares about the Sabbath. He cares about keeping the law. And here's the thing that, honestly, if there's one thing I've learned, is that the more I've studied early Judaism and the more I've looked at Jesus again in that context, I have felt less and less like a good Jesus follower and like a Christian. And I don't mean that in terms of like, well, I ought to do better, but just in terms of like, man, Jesus is a lot different than me. And I've become fine with that. So that what it looks like, really, it's put me more in a place of learning, of like continually like, all right, what does Jesus say and do? And being able to admit that like, you know, I don't do that. I mean, one, I'm a Gentile. I don't keep the Sabbath. And rather than me trying to think through, well, maybe the Sunday is the new Sabbath. I'm not saying there's things you can't learn from it or that's
sure.
not important. But first, I want to admit that I'm not actually trying to keep the Sabbath from sundown, you know.
Right. On Friday through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus actually did, and he cared about that. So it's honestly made Jesus less and less familiar to me. But I kind of like that because at least it makes me feel a little bit more honest about my attempts to follow him, mm-hmm. you know? So mm-hmm. I hope that makes sense.
It does. It's very, very helpful. So yeah. So I don't think we made it all the way through the list, on these kind of essential pillars of what early yeah. Judaism looked like.
Yeah.
So what are our final few?
So there are two more central pillars, but I put these as a caveat because there is evidence that not every, Jew in the first century necessarily held to these last two. But this sixth pillar would be resurrection, a belief that the dead will, that God will eventually raise the dead and there will be a final judgment, which also somewhat ties into the seventh point, which is the belief in some sort of physical salvation, for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And that is also tied into the concept of a Messiah. So those last two are very broadly held beliefs in early Judaism. Not everybody, but they are very common. So,
yeah.
Now, I think that kind of, I don't know if you want to get into this or not, but I feel like it's helpful to point out, though, that if those are the pillars as far as beliefs and practice, again, people are going, you know what, I left one out. Let me throw in the synagogue.
Okay.
For all branches of Judaism, the synagogue as an institution is fundamental to daily life or weekly life. And that is a new development. The synagogue does not exist in the Old Testament, but it's a development in the early stages of early Judaism that becomes pivotal, just like going to church is for us, or going to masjid for Islam is, you know. So... We could talk about the issue, though, I think, real quick, about Judaism versus Judaisms, or is that too obtuse?
No, I think it warrants some attention.
Okay, so, I mean, really the only point I want to make
there's
there...
quite a bit to say about it, but there's a few things I think could be
yeah.
practical and useful
yeah.
for people.
So recently in scholarship, there has been a debate about, is there a single Judaism we can talk about, or should we rather talk about various Judaisms? And I think I've told this to you before. I actually think part of that is really just a rhetorical debate. I think people can get lost in the verbiage. But it is a valid point. Like, what we're asking there is, how diverse was early Judaism? Early on in scholarship, this ties into the anti-Semitism issue. You often had contrasted in scholarship Hellenistic Judaism and Palestinian Judaism,
right,
or Rabbinic Judaism.
Right.
And that was often done for the sake of Christians and scholars wanting to champion Hellenistic Judaism and explain, well, Jesus is progressive, the apostles are progressive because they're Hellenistic, whereas there's the old school Rabbinic legalistic Palestinian Judaism. Mm-hmm. But of course, now we're in a place where we start to realize, when you actually carefully read the literature, all of these Judaisms share the things in common that I just talked about. Those beliefs, but there's also plenty of diversity, so that you can't just, it would be oversimplifying to say that everybody fit within those two categories, or to even oppose them like that. So what I mean by that is Jews in Babylon and Jews in Alexandria and Egypt, who aren't in the land of Israel, are still keeping the law. It might look different in a lot of cases, but they're still keeping the law. They're still sending tithes to the temple. If they can, they will go visit the temple. Acts is a good, actually, indicator of that. You have people from around the world at Pentecost, and those are Jews. Those are not Gentiles. So while you have a lot of diversity in various opinions and emphases in Judaism, you also have that common core. So I think a good, I choose that kind of middle ground. I'm really fine with whatever verbiage, Judaism or Judaisms. But really the main point is that Judaism is diverse. You can't just pigeonhole Judaism into one thing, which does often happen in Christian conversations. You know, as a good example, a lot of times in church when we talk about the Messiah and the Jewish concept, it's often said, well, the Jews believed in the Messiah, as if there was really only one belief about the Messiah. But in fact, there were a handful of various beliefs, and there's indication that some people did not, either they didn't believe in the Messiah or they just didn't care much about it. So you can't pigeonhole all of Jews. For example, you know, it's like, well, why did the Jews reject Jesus? He was the Messiah. It's like, well, because plenty of them didn't actually think, one, the Messiah would ever look like that, and there are plenty of other people who probably just didn't care. So it's always a little more complicated. So
I love that example. I think it's a really important one. It was even occurring to me as you were speaking. You know, there's this idea. I think actually we could have framed this whole thing around just misunderstandings that Christianity makes,
yeah,
about ancient Judaism, early Judaism. Mm-hmm. And one has to be a militant Messiah.
Yeah.
Everybody was expecting David.
Yes,
they get Jesus,
yeah,
instead and are surprised.
Yeah.
It's just not, this is where I probably, mm-hmm, we may have some difference. I tend to think that the debate is a more than rhetorical, and I think that Judaism is probably a better frame.
Okay.
But we won't dive into all of that today, only to say that some people expected a Davidic king.
Yeah.
Some people were expecting, probably not really thinking,
yeah,
about it, / expecting nothing at all.
Yeah.
Some people expected other kind of portrayals,
yeah,
or construals.
I mean, the Essenes said we have some evidence of two messiahs.
Yeah, I don't.
A Davidic and then priestly messiah.
I see. Yeah, all right. Yeah, so you end up with, and so these different sects are highlighting different parts of the law and the prophets,
yeah,
therefore constructing a different kind of expected messiah.
Yeah.
Was Jesus as messiah surprising to Jewish people and sects, and undermining, challenging certain expectations? Yes.
Yeah.
And also clearly for some, no,
yeah,
because they were following him,
yeah,
and there was expectation of his rule.
Another thing I often like to bring up when talking about early Judaism and how Christians perceive it is actually talking about legalism. So we've all probably grown up, if we've grown up in the church, hearing that Paul especially, and Jesus, their main target was Jewish legalism. And oftentimes, it's also then assumed that Judaism itself must have been legalistic. In a large part, we have the Reformation to thank for that. But it's not just the Reformation. To be fair to that history, there are other issues throughout church history where Judaism is still cast as a religion of the book in a negative way. But I often like to explain it this way. One, I don't like the word legalism because it, again, not to just harp on rhetoric, but I think it's another rhetorical device to just separate other people from you without actually considering what's going on and what that looks like. So we think of Judaism as a religion that tries to earn merit through good works, and those good works being obeying the law, legalism. It's applicable to even today, because I think a lot of people then assume still that Jews are just legalistic. But it's really an unfair characterization of Judaism both then and now. One of the questions I often get was, how is it even possible to live that life? How is it possible to read all of the laws in the Old Testament and obey them? And I like to clarify a few things and explain it this way, and that's that of all the laws in the Old Testament, the regular Jew is not observing all of them. Some of those laws concern the temple and how it's supposed to function. Some of those laws concern the priesthood and how they function. Some of those laws are particular to women. Some of those laws are particular to specific business functions. So really, at the end of the day, if you're thinking of the average Jew, there's not that many laws or stipulations that you have to think through about keeping. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So it's not as complex, I think, as people first think. But then even if we still think, because we don't live that life, if we still think it's too complicated and too legalistic, I like to remind people that their own lives are governed by cultural assumptions that you don't even think about. You still live your lives by various rules and cultural
norms. That's actually where I begin as well. There are probably more laws for the American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in fact, I say probably, certainly, more laws for the American citizen than what you would find in the Law and the Prophets of ancient Judaism. And we don't really find those to be, and as I'm saying this, some of you are like, we do find them to be onerous. Well, I mean, what I mean by that is that you may disagree with one or two or even several specific laws, but most of the laws that exist that govern our behavior, they don't even occur to us.
Yeah.
We're not even really actively reflecting on them.
Yeah.
It's not necessary to go through examples, but I mean, it's quite obvious, right? Yeah. Like most of the things we're doing, it's just in the water. We're not challenging it.
Yeah.
And that has to be, you know, one of the most, I mean, you have Jesus saying, like, my yoke, my way, my teaching is light.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? I mean, what is he contrasting himself against? He's not contrasting himself against all of Judaism.
Yeah.
He's offering a specific rabbinic way of being within Judaism.
Yeah. Yeah.
A strand within the within Judaism broadly, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I didn't come to abolish the law,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, there's no real actually linguistic shock moment here. Abolish means abolish. I didn't come to get rid of the law.
Yeah. Yeah.
I came to fulfill it.
Yeah.
I came to represent it in its fullest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually a perfect
example. It's very straightforward, actually.
Well, but we're able to, a lot of the times in Christian theology, to read that passage and then immediately go and say, but that's actually a great example. The Sermon on the Mount is one of my favorite.
Yeah. Okay. We need to talk about the Sermon on the Mount. What's happening? And we spent, I don't know how long we spent as a church on the Sermon on the Mount. We probably spent, at least 6 months on it. What's happening in the Sermon on the Mount? Is this long example of the elimination of Second Temple Judaism,
yeah.
which is a part of a subcategory of ancient yeah. Judaism.
So, to focus on the latter part, I mean, we're going to skip the blessing.
Cameron has a book out now, by the way.
The book out. It's called The Bible.
Oh, okay. That's what that is. I thought it was a Tolstoy or something.
Yeah. So to skip the Beatitudes, which in and of themselves are just full of Jewish idiom. I mean, there's crossovers with the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's crossovers with rabbinic literature. So those themselves are thoroughly saturated in Jewish thought. But to get to the part to where in verse 17, Matthew 5:17, he says, "Do not think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've come not to abolish, but to fulfill." So straight up, he says, "I'm not getting rid of the law." And I would like to point out that even those phrases there, this is a debate we don't have to get into because I know we probably disagree somewhat, but if you read rabbinic literature, this whole passage is replete with rabbinic themes and verbiage. And I think verbiage is key. Because we can read this in English, and we're so familiar with it in Christian theology that we assume we know what it means. But if you read it through the ears of an early Jew, Jesus is saying, "I've not come to get rid of the law or tear down any law. I've come to establish them." And you said fulfill and bring its fullest meaning. And I think that's true. But in that fulfill is the concept of uphold and keep. And then he goes on but the way we get around that, though, is because then we read the next part, verses 18 and onward, where he says in verse 21, "You have heard that it was said." And then in sermons and in Christian theology, we then immediately latch onto that. We say, well, this was the Torah or the Old Testament, and Jesus is saying, but here's what I say, it's new teaching. And yet, the phraseology here is exactly like rabbinic phraseology. Like, "you have heard it said" is all throughout rabbinic literature for someone taught to you. Not, it's in the Old Testament, or not, this is Judaism. It's a particular sage or a particular teaching is about that says this. And so, for example, verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, 'You shall not murder,'" which is a quote from the Old Testament, "'and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment.'" That phrase is not in the Old Testament.
I was going to say, it's not in the Old Testament.
Yeah,
right.
And a lot of commentators will then take that and say, well, Jesus is just summarizing. Because it does say that. There are passages in the Torah that say, you know, murder, you get judged, right? I didn't bring it with me, but there's a particular...
Well, I'll be curious how you elaborate on that.
Yeah.
I have a view on that, which I will certainly share. Go ahead.
There is a particular, albeit late, there's a particular passage in the Talmud where they're talking about the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments, and they're saying, here's, "You shall not murder," and this is itself tied to another passage, which is, "You are liable to judgment." Okay. And it goes throughout each commandment in the Decalogue and ties it to that in such a way that what the rabbis do is create a fuller meaning out of the Decalogue. And then they ultimately actually tie it to creation. So, and while Jesus doesn't go through the entire Decalogue here, he performs a similar task by showing that what he's quoting is exactly that. Someone along the way said, "You have heard it said, you know, you shall not murder." And then they tied it to another principle of whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. Because if you just read, "You shall not murder," that leaves it open. What's going to happen? Somebody along the way came and tied it to another principle or another passage. And so Jesus is here is taking a teaching, and then he's offering a different teaching. He's not getting rid of the law. He himself is actually engaging in the conversation and saying, no, here's how we should interpret it. And so also in that rabbinic passage that I mentioned in the Talmud, they also go on to say, what counts as murder? And they tie it to another passage in a different place to argue that murder also includes libel. It also includes slander, which is exactly what Jesus says. So this whole thing Jesus is doing is very Jewish. And it's not merely, hey, I have an idea, here's how things should be. It's actually a complex thought process that I think takes time to uncover.
Here's where I think that for those who are listening through this and like, okay, this is just this kind of deep dive, and if you are struggling with relevance, I don't presume that our listenership is, but like, if there is that, I think this is a very good example of like something that is directly relevant and what it means to actually, as you said earlier, interact with this Jesus who is, which is making Jesus strange to us again,
yeah.
making Jesus other to us again,
yeah.
Which we have this tendency to domesticate you, to make him like us in all of these ways. So
yeah.
I want to elaborate on, we'll stick with this passage for a second. Here, the wrong way to read this is, I mean, you said it, but the wrong way to read this is, here's Jesus overriding, tossing out, making irrelevant the Torah.
Yeah.
The law and the prophets. What's really happening here is something much more interesting, and this is where I think a more Jewish reading of the New Testament it becomes very valuable,
mm-hmm.
because we want to see Jesus as a model in this way. You heard that it was said, "Do not murder." I say to you,
yeah.
You know, whoever has anger in his
yeah.
in his heart, essentially. This isn't a throwing out. It's actually this very, as you said, very Jewish thing where you're saying, "Okay, you've heard that this is what you should not do." I want to actually build around the law. I want to build. Construct. I want to extend this
yeah.
so that the law. You know how you're never going to violate. You know how you're never going to violate the law about not murdering. If you make sure that you are reflective, prayerful, intentional about addressing even anger in your heart. You know what you're never going to do. You're never going to murder.
Yeah.
So there's actually this high value
mm-hmm.
place by making this more rigorous. There's this. High value placed on the
yeah.
law. It's not devaluing the
yeah.
law. If you want to avoid adultery, you want to not sleep with somebody that is not your spouse.
Yeah.
And you really want to honor that. You don't want to find yourself in the chaos of something like that, in the
yeah.
chaos of murder, in the chaos of, you know, what have you. These really life-destroying things, then.
Yeah.
You're going to be very cautious about even passing moments
yeah.
of lust toward another person
yeah.
that is not your spouse. So what's happening actually at once is Jesus is, I think, adding a level of rigor to
yeah.
the law and protecting it.
Yeah.
And so, no, I don't know that we're in disagreement at all about this. I think we need to see these as extensions.
Yeah.
But that is what I mean
yeah.
about like this caricature of like, Just. I frankly think just reducing Jesus. I do think Jesus is radical, but just reducing Jesus to radical, just
yeah.
reducing
yeah.
reducing Jesus to revolutionary, I think takes away all of the texture
yeah.
of what it means to be somebody who's like him. Somebody who's like him is somebody who's engaging the world in the same way that he engaged and at times adopted, I think, thoughts of the Hellenistic world, but is like processing that through
yeah.
their faith system. That's a complex thing
yeah.
that's way more about ethics. And kingdom building
yeah.
than it is about just like tear it down.
Yeah. I think Jesus is a radical in the sense that he's a genius. I mean, I frankly do think he is a genius. He's not some.
It's a very useful frame.
yeah.
yeah.
He's not from the backwaters coming out, which is again often how it's contrasted. You have the scribes and the Pharisees, and Jesus must be a backwater hick.
As opposed to probably more like a Pharisee.
Yeah.
With
very,
Essene kind
yeah.
of. You know what, some Essene tendencies, much
yeah.
more Pharisee.
I think he criticizes the Essenes, but that'd be another issue. But
yeah,
no,
so.
There are tendencies. And so what you said, I'd like to confirm that, because, and again, in rabbinic language, it's what you described is called building a fence around the Torah,
right?
So you extend the boundary a little bit further. And again, we call that legalism, but that's exactly what Jesus is doing. And it's not about making things harder. It's actually about, in some sense, making things holier
right,
and easier, if done rightly. Jesus has criticisms for the Pharisees against overburdening people.
Right.
But he's not criticizing them about building fences. He's about
right
making it so hard. You know?
And when we call that legalism,
mm-hmm.
we're wrongly calling it legalism.
Yes.
Because when you say making things easier, I agree with that if I understand what you mean by that. But what I take from something like the Sermon on the Mount, and when we talk about making things easier, what we mean is
yeah.
realizing through and through, like, the godly order of our lives by extending, by building this fence, by extending this, we are making even the most, like, visceral, like, moments of our life, the parts of our lives that incur the most suffering, we're making those, in a sense, more holy.
Yeah.
Like, the way we experience even the worst things, as you said. So, yeah, easier in that way.
Yeah.
But still, I will double down a little bit on, like, but still more rigorous.
Oh, no, no, definitely. Because
it's actually harder to manage your anger, right, than to just, like, kind of let it go.
Absolutely.
And hope that it doesn't come to fruition in murder, say.
Yeah. To the point of Jesus actually being more strict in some cases. I think you are right, because he actually, in several places, criticizes the Pharisees for being too lax, for providing a way out of, for example, providing for your family by giving an offering to the temple.
Right. Okay.
So I think it brings it all back around to the point, though, that this is an internal conversation. The sages in early Judaism, the word for the rabbis, and especially the Pharisees, are actually in many ways quite liberal. While we've cast them as legalistic, there are plenty of places where they've actually provided out to more strict laws in the Old Testament. So, for example, eye for an eye and capital punishment, they've provided ways to say that, well, in many cases, actually, you can just provide monetary compensation. You don't actually have to kill the person. There's often debates about, okay, if somebody gives witness in court, but they end up lying, do we put them to death or do we not? And in many cases, some sages land on the side of, no, we're not going to put them to death. They just have to pay back the money. So in many ways, the Pharisees are actually kind of liberal. We also have cases where some of the laws they're providing, for example, about using stone vessels for the sake of purity. You can even tie some of those to historical evidence that those laws were actually passed to provide financial gain for the stone industry. So, like, even these religious and legal conversations, sometimes they're about spiritual matters, sometimes they're what we would just consider legal or court matters, and in some cases, there's financial impetus behind them. So, like, it would be entirely wrong to say that, you know, you have Jesus over here who's liberal and progressive and revolutionary, and then you have the Pharisees who are legalistic and old school, when in fact, they're both mixes of both spectrums. Jesus is at some points more lax on some things, but in other cases, like you pointed out here, actually more strict. I mean, like I said, the things he says here, actually, they occur in rabbinic literature where they come to the same conclusions. You know, it's not just murder, it's slander. It's calling somebody an idiot in public. I mean, there's a rabbinic example where they actually say, what counts as this? And the phrase offered is, if someone says, there's always a fire going on in their house, which means they're always cooking. And then they say, well, does that count? Like, what does that even mean? And then they clarify, well, it's the intent that matters. If you're walking along and you talk about your neighbor, which is kind of relevant right now, maybe. Again, another example where I feel maybe I'm not as much like Jesus as I'd hope to be. But if you say to your neighbor, well, he's always cooking a fire in his house, like, God, he's always eating, that is slander. That's speaking ill of somebody in public, and that is liable to judgment. And so Jesus here agrees. Call somebody an idiot. That lands you, we can debate whether that's final judgment before God or before the court, but in either case, Jesus is extending that fence around the law, because in his conception, and even the Pharisaic conception, all life is sacred. I mean, the Torah is not just what it literally says word for word. It's there's more to it that we can learn from. So, yeah.
Yes, I find that to be very insightful, and I hope that it's adding texture to how we think about Judaism, how we think about our own, you know, our own faith system.
Can I provide, and you can cut this out later if you want.
Yeah, no.
One more example. I was actually reading this the other day in the Talmud that ties into this, and I'm not going to say historically there's an exact connection, because it's more complicated to dig through those texts and this text, and there's the whole date issue. This literature was finally edited by, you know, the 6th century, whereas here we're talking about the 1st.
Yeah, one fast caveat on Talmudic literature.
well, how can we know that it carries any authority? Because, I mean, obviously it didn't happen in a vacuum, right?
Sure.
So what you see happening in Talmudic literature is no doubt different than, but also a reflection of the history of the faith that preceded it. So there's 30 seconds on that.
Yeah, that's a good caveat. So it's a complex issue. But I will say, so I was reading, and they are also talking about adultery. So you have one of the Ten Commandments, adultery. And they say, well, it's more than just having sex with somebody else's wife or husband. It actually involves both your eyes and your heart, your lust. And it also involves helping somebody else to commit adultery. And I say it's complex because they're not just combining ideas here. It's not just theology. They actually have a complex logic that they go through to tie passages in the Old Testament to arrive at this. But one of the rabbis throws out a phrase and says, in fact, masturbation counts. And the phrase he uses is says, isn't it better that you would lose the hand and the foot in regards to masturbation? I don't know how feet play into masturbation, but it's just
one of the many mysteries.
Isn't it better isn't it better that that happens than that you lose it to judgment?
Right.
And that is exactly what
Jesus
says.
Yet another very good example.
Yeah, and I am also confused as to what foot means here with Jesus. Either it's going to help somebody to commit adultery or...
Or some kind of symbolism of...
But I also think, to tie that back in, I think masturbation's involved with Jesus here. Mm-hmm. If I had to tie in the cultural context and the logic, I'm sure in some ways they're related. So another way to think through this is, that sounds pretty strict. I mean, as Christians, we all grew up with that, probably.
Right.
Not to dive into sex here, but hey, to make it relevant... if I had to bet, Jesus was probably against masturbating.
That's it. We may have our title.
We have a title. That's what we'll title the podcast. Anyways, so yeah, there are many ways that Jesus builds this fence around the law. Some of these sound good to us. Some of them we'd be like, I don't know about that. But
To double down or to underscore Jesus and sexuality as well as Jesus and the law.
Yeah.
This is, I think it's useful because the two things can be brought up on this point. First, I don't know if it's a minority of scholars or not. I actually don't know really where all the scholars are on something like the moral law that you find in the Torah and the prophets.
Yeah.
Versus the ceremonial law. Mm. I don't really... And again, I don't know where, like, most scholarship is on this. Who I've read, and I'm fairly convinced, that I don't really see a distinction there.
No, yeah.
So maybe we're of like mind on that. Why do I bring that up? Because here's what you have a lot of the time happening, I think, within Christian communities. You, again, hear this usually from, like, from leadership within Christian communities. Mm-hmm. Some of the Old Testament is ceremonial, therefore can be discarded. Some of the Old Testament is moral, therefore should be retained. I think there are really some insightful and smart people that think this. It happens to not be my view. Why is that maybe unhelpful? And I think it connects to Sermon on the Mount. I think it connects to modern values concerning sexuality versus ancient values concerning sexuality. I think a more honest treatment is that distinction is not there in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
And what actually you see happening is that Judaism, like Christianity, evolves and changes.
Yeah, yeah.
And some practices at one time were considered unacceptable and now are considered acceptable. Mm-hmm. And that evolution is a part of a living faith.
Yeah.
And you see that happening in the scriptures.
Yeah.
E.P. Sanders... You know, he talks about, and I can't remember all of it, I think he brings up three key features of ancient Judaism, early Christianity, that we just discard as a society. One is values surrounding sexuality, to which some of our listeners will be like, no, I adhere to the values of concerning sexuality in the ancient world. In the New Testament, you may not, because there's a lot of values around marriage that are really like totally antithetical to the way we think about marriage now.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I don't want to. That's too much of a rabbit hole to go all the way down. But like, just to point out that when we think about the utility or the function of sex in marriage,
mm-hmm.
Most people don't see that solely or primarily as about childbearing, even though it's a feature.
Yeah.
The other is about how we honor and respect the government, and then there's a third. My point being that if we begin to parse some of, when it comes to how we read the Bible, we begin to parse some of these things so that we can like kind of cherry pick.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas maybe the more honest answer is we see the faith of Judaism and Christianity evolving and
yeah.
changing.
Oh yeah. Well, and let me provide the caveat too. Even as I mentioned rabbinic literature and one rabbi saying this and another saying that, like, it's not uniform. In fact, what rabbinic literature and Jewish conversation is known for is disagreement.
Right.
Judaism has been able to handle... Disagreement is a central function of Judaism.
It's a central feature of how we
yeah.
read the Bible.
Yeah. And
funnily
so,
enough, it's one of the very things that so many churches try to... I don't know that they're... I don't want to misrepresent communities that are great communities that I love.
Sure.
But
yeah.
that are like... I don't think intentionally, but are kind of squelching.
Yeah.
Like, no, the better mechanism
yeah.
is that we're in conversation and agreeing and disagreeing about
yeah.
what we do with these texts.
Yeah.
This has been part one of Jeremy and Cameron's conversation over the history of Judaism. Next week on the podcast, part two.